In Ukraine, along the front lines, a dam is destroyed. Thousands of people are forced to flee.
I'm scared that this flood can move all these debris. It can move also whole houses.
Also today, thousands of Rohingya Muslims are boarding wooden boats in Bangladesh, looking to start new lives. The ocean journey is treacherous. One boat simply vanished at sea.
And yet there was no official investigation into what had happened to this boat. And it was just kind of shocking to me that 180 human beings could disappear and the world didn't even blink.
I'm Marco Werman. Plus, Iran claims it has a new hypersonic missile capable of weaving past missile defense systems.
So if you have many of these weapons fired at once, it really could be a disaster scenario.
Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Thank you for joining us. In Ukraine today, a massive dam was destroyed along the front lines of the war. Floodwaters are now inundating towns and villages. It's not clear how the Kakhovka Dam was damaged. Russia is blaming Ukraine. Ukraine is blaming Russia.
Європі і світу. Це найбільша рукотворна екологічна катастрофа в Європі за...
President Volodymyr Zelensky today called it the largest man-made environmental disaster in Europe in decades. The World's Carolyn Beeler is in Kyiv and joins us for more. Carolyn, it is the Dnipro River that feeds this dam. Tell us where the Dnipro River flows and why it's so important to Ukraine.
The Dnipro is Ukraine's most important river. It runs north-south through the middle of the country, starting up at the border with Belarus, running through where I am right now in Kyiv, and then dumping out into the Black Sea. And in southeastern Ukraine, where this dam is located, the river is the front line of fighting. The western bank is Ukrainian-held, and the eastern bank is occupied by Russia.
So the Kakhovka Dam is in Russian-held territory, located near the southern part of the Dnipro, roughly 50 miles upriver, I see, from the city of Kherson. So far, Carolyn, what's the impact of this breach?
It's unleashing just massive amounts of water. The Kakhovka Reservoir is Ukraine's largest. It holds just a little less water than the Great Salt Lake in Utah. It's 150 miles long. And as of late afternoon, some of that water had inundated more than a dozen towns or villages south of the dam. 1,300 people have been evacuated. On social media, we're seeing videos of entire houses that have been swept away, floating in the floodwaters, people trying to bring their livestock up to higher ground, a guy rowing a boat through the town trying to save people.
Yeah, just a sign of the catastrophe here. And of major concern is the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant, which is nearby. And early reports are that this flooding could impact its operations. What can you tell us?
So the Kakhovka Reservoir, the reservoir that is now losing water, is the source of cooling water for the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant. It's pumped from the reservoir to help remove excess heat from the reactors and spent fuel ponds. Now, if that water were to run out, that would be a big problem. It would cause fuel melt. However, the International Atomic Energy Agency said today that it doesn't see any immediate risk to safety of the plant. The water in the reservoir should be enough to cool the plant for a few days. And then there's also a cooling pond on site of the plant that could provide enough water to cool the reactors for many months, according to an estimate from the Atomic Energy Agency.
So, Carolyn, you're in Ukraine actually reporting on the environmental impacts of the war, and this dam burst, of course, is a huge example of that. What should we be expecting to hear about in the weeks to come in terms of what we're seeing today?
Yeah, with any big flood, of course, you know, the first concern is what gets swept away or inundated. But another concern is what gets picked up and carried along with the floodwaters. You know, it gets filled with sewage that's overflown, pesticides from farm fields, chemicals from industrial sites, and all this gets transported with the water. It can get deposited on the land. It can make people sick. And of course, it does impact the land itself.
And other than people's health, homes, and communities, are there specific areas of concern environmentally?
Yeah, in this case, the flooding has already inundated two national parks along the banks of the Dnipro River, and it's headed for the Delta area with the Black Sea. Katrina Polyanska is an environmental scientist in Kyiv who's been speaking with her colleagues down in Kherson and watching for updated satellite images to track the damage being done by this rush of floodwaters to those areas.
I'm scared that this flood can destroy our ecosystem in our national parks, and also I'm scared that this flood can move all these debris. It can move also whole houses and everything to the Dnipro Delta. and then we will have this also huge problem.
Polyanska works for an NGO called Environment People Law. She mentioned the Dnipro Delta there. That's where, of course, the Dnipro meets the Black Sea, and where there are protected wetland and steppe and sand dune ecosystems.
We have very rare ecosystem, and they have some endemic species which you can meet just in this part of the world.
She's concerned that half or more of the populations of these species that are found only here could be wiped out. She says it's going to take a few days to see the full extent of the damage, and she will be watching along with, of course, lots of other people, Marco.
Well, we are hoping for the best. The world's Carolyn Beeler is in Kyiv. Thanks very much, Carolyn. Thanks for your reporting.
You're welcome, Marco.
In Israel, a 2-year-old boy shot recently by Israeli forces has died in the hospital, a sad reminder of the impacts of the escalating violence between Israel and Palestinians in the West Bank. Fouad Abu Ghosh is a reporter who went to the funeral for the 2-year-old. Fouad, what was it like at this funeral? What was the scene there?
Many people, the whole town was on strike. They didn't go to school today. It was full of sadness over the village today.
Yeah, evident in this recording you made. Fouad, what's going on here? What's being chanted?
These are the little kids and the adults who are following the body of the late Mohammed Tamimi, shouting, "With our blood and soul, we'll defend the martyr." And it's a very common saying.
I mean, as you said, school was out today for this funeral, and we heard those children chanting. That must have been pretty dramatic to see those kids supporting, you know, another child.
Yes, indeed. In fact, the first role at the funeral, it was kids, like kids as young as 2 and 3 years old, holding the flag of Palestine and having the keffiyeh band on their forehead. This is something that you don't really see every day. So to me, this was like really shocking. This was like my wake-up call this morning.
Wow. Fouad, take us back and tell us what happened. What events led to this toddler getting shot and killed?
This little kid, Mohammed Tamimi, and his father were outside their house. They were between the source of the fire and the second entrance to the village, the checkpoint. And unfortunately, they got shot both.
Fouad, clarify this. Were the Israeli forces shooting first or were they shot at first?
This is the dispute. They were shot at, according to local eyewitnesses. They said some people from that corner, from the west side of the village, they were shooting at that soldier. The soldier's reaction, it was like they shot back at the source of the fire.
When you spoke with the family of Mohammed Tamimi, the boy, what did they say?
They were like looking for words. They were so sad. And everyone I looked at, they were with tears in their eyes. Even the father, I looked at the father and I approached him. I tried to ask him a question or two. He just couldn't answer. He just said no with his hand. They left the body uncovered. And I was shocked to watch the little face of this kid covered with the flowers. To me, this is like a scene that you do not see every day.
Right. Have the Israeli authorities, Fouad, commented on what happened?
According to local media in Israel, they will look into this case and they will investigate. Recently, we've been seeing a lot of attacks on Israelis in the West Bank by Palestinians. The current government wants to prove to the public opinion in Israel that they are strong enough and they can prevent these attacks. So that's why the action coming fast and quick, especially when we have the Minister of National Security from the far right. Also, he is encouraging these kind of actions by the police, by the border police and by the IDF in order to secure the safety of the settlers on the West Bank.
Fouad Abu Ghosh is a reporter in Israel and the Palestinian territories, helping us understand the circumstances around the death of a 2-year-old Palestinian toddler. Fouad, thank you very much.
Thank you, Marcos. Thank you for having me.
In a London courtroom today, harsh words leveled at the British press. how much more blood will stain their typing fingers before someone can put a stop to this madness? That was a direct quote from none other than Prince Harry. The member of the royal family is suing a British tabloid for using private investigators to gather information illegally about him over a 15-year period. The World's Europe correspondent Orla Barry has more.
Prince Harry has never made a secret of his feelings about the British tabloids.
Going back to the relationship between certain members of the family and the tabloid press, those certain members have decided to get into bed with the devil.
That was Harry speaking to ITV, a UK news channel, earlier this year. And this morning, the British news media was out in force as the Prince arrived at the High Court in London.
This is Prince Harry, we think.
Harry didn't speak to the gaggle of reporters and photographers packed outside the courthouse, even though this was a pretty exceptional moment for a member of the British royal family.
The last time such a senior member was cross-examined in court was actually in 1891, and that was Prince Harry's ancestor, the future Edward VII.
This is historian Elizabeth Norton. She says the royal family has always wanted to control how it's perceived by the British public, and facing cross-examination in a court proceeding could be risky. But Norton says British royals have sued newspapers in the past.
Prince Albert, back in the 19th century, took legal action against the press. The late Queen sued members of the press. So it happens. The difference is almost always these lead to an out-of-court settlement.
Today's court case isn't just about Prince Harry. More than 100 other claimants are part of the lawsuit. They include actors, sports stars, celebrities, and some individuals who just had a connection to high-profile figures. They're arguing that the Mirror newspaper hacked phones or used other unlawful methods to dig up personal details that the paper later published. The allegations of phone hacking by British tabloids go back several years.
This really is an earthquake. Rupert Murdoch owns a bunch of papers here. This scandal has rocked his media empire to the core.
In 2011, Rupert Murdoch shut down the News of the World tabloid over illegal phone hacking charges. A number of journalists also went to jail. But the scandal didn't end there.
I mean, one of the reasons we haven't got to the bottom of this is that what particularly the News Corp, the Rupert Murdoch organisation, did was that they paid off people.
Paul Lashmer is an investigative journalist and media lecturer at City University in London.
As a result, there are, you know, literally hundreds of cases that have never been properly disclosed and discussed. But this group of claimants are saying, we want our day in court, and Prince Harry is certainly doing that.
The Mirror newspaper group has settled hundreds of phone hacking claims, costing an estimated $125 million. In court today, Prince Harry said he has faced hostility from the press since the day he was born. Harry also alleged that Piers Morgan, the former editor of the Mirror newspaper, listened to phone messages left by his mother, Princess Diana, 3 months before her death. A lawyer for the newspaper group says there's no evidence of phone hacking in Harry's case. Journalism professor Paul Lashmer says the Mirror newspaper has done a lot over the last decade to try and clean up its act. But he says the phone hacking scandal has damaged the news business.
My concern is that it undermines the good work, the courage of so many reporters who go out in the field, are in Ukraine and many other dangerous parts of the world. And this phone hacking stuff has done tremendous damage to the reputation of the industry as a whole.
Prince Harry is expected to take the stand again tomorrow, and the case is likely to continue for 3 more weeks. But even if the royal prince loses this time around, he has other lawsuits in the works against 2 of Britain's leading tabloids, the Daily Mail and the Rupert Murdoch-owned newspaper, The Sun. For The World, I'm Orla Barry.
Just ahead on the show, a PR campaign to persuade Americans that border policies are being enforced. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. The number of people trying to cross the U.S. southern border has fallen in recent weeks. That's not what was predicted. A few reasons for this. For starters, more asylum seekers are using the smartphone app required by Customs and Border Protection. That means they're waiting on the other side of the border for an appointment with U.S. immigration officials. There's also something else going on, a new public relations effort by the Biden administration. Here's The World's TV Isaiah on that.
U.S. immigration authorities have been sharing a video that shows a group of men chained and handcuffed boarding the stairs onto a plane. The video doesn't have any narration, but it's pretty clear that these men are being deported. The description says that the men are being sent from El Paso, Texas, to Honduras. The video is an example of something new from U.S. immigration agencies.
They have never publicized their activities to this degree, ever.
Tom Cartwright has been tracking deportation flights taking off from the United States for years.
I have seen those flights, but generally I had to sneak to the airport and hide to be able to film the flights to see what was actually taking place. So they wouldn't even in the past confirm for a journalist that there was a deportation flight.
Now, U.S. immigration officials have organized media events at American airports inviting journalists to report on the removal flights. In some of these videos, you can see the use of restrictive elements like handcuffs at the feet and hands, including for women with children.
It's really very disgusting because these people are in very vulnerable situations. And to make a show of it, to me, is on the edge of cruelty.
Last month, the government of Colombia briefly suspended deportation flights from the U.S., citing cruel and degrading treatment of migrants. The flights were restarted the following week after U.S. officials agreed to protect the human rights of migrants. Tom Cartwright says the Biden administration is eager to show that there will be consequences for those who cross the border without permission.
These, in essence, to me, are almost perp walks. The primary purpose is for these to be put on in the foreign press so that people can see it and for deterrence.
He says the public diplomacy campaign is aimed at sending a message that the border is not open.
U.S. immigration laws remain strict.
We are about to return up to 100 Venezuelan migrants.
There are consequences for unlawful entry.
Dozens of deportation flights take place every week.
We are making it very clear that our border is not open.
These are some examples from videos posted on Twitter by Customs and Border Protection. The actual number of deportation flights has gone down, according to Tom Cartwright. It's between 5 and 6 flights per week. But Julia Gillard from the Migration Policy Institute says there is another reason for this PR campaign from Joe Biden's administration, and it's directed toward a domestic audience.
Immigration is really a politically difficult issue for him. On the one hand, he's wanted to project that he's welcoming to immigrants and is, you know, in favor of immigration overall. On the other hand, he's wanted to be really tough at the border because high numbers of border arrivals are difficult politically.
Stephanie Brewer with the Washington Office on Latin America says the Biden administration's policies are not actually very different from those of his predecessor.
So we see, once again, repetition of what look and feel and sound and have the effects of Trump-era measures. And that's what's really concerning. A message that is focused on deterrence and blocking and deportation.
Brewer says deterrence policies might work for a while, but not in the long term, because so many migrants have no choice but to flee their home countries. For the world, I'm Tibisa Isaiah.
Iran is claiming it has a powerful new weapon in its arsenal, a hypersonic missile capable of traveling 15 times the speed of sound, fast enough to pierce through air defense systems. The new missile is called Fatah, that's conqueror in Farsi. Behnam Ben Taloglu has been looking into the implications of this. He's a senior fellow at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies and joins us from Washington. Behnam, Iran choreographed the unveiling of this new missile on state TV. Has it been independently verified that Iran indeed has this new weapon and it can work?
Essentially, piecing together what we know about this system in the open source and the limited video they put out, which is a combination of an actual solid propellant missile test and some select animation, it looks like Iran is taking an aggregate definition to the word hypersonic. You mentioned at least a hypersonic missile has to be able to travel beyond Mach 5. This allegedly goes anywhere from Mach 12 to 14, depending on different reports that you see in the Persian language press. Some of that may be bravado, some of that may be real, but this is a capability the Iranians are interested in developing. What I would say for our listeners is as follows. Even Iran's regular ballistic missiles, some of them, when they re-enter the atmosphere, they re-enter at hypersonic speeds. So they re-enter even at above Mach 5. Iran may have taken that fact and added a more maneuverable re-entry vehicle based on a new, smaller, solid rocket motor that was unveiled and that Iran is also using for some of its space programs, and together try to create the aggregate definition of an hypersonic ballistic missile rather than revealing that it actually has a hypersonic glide vehicle.
What is the range of this hypersonic missile if fired from Iran? Do we know that?
So the regime says that it is put on top of a solid propellant ballistic missile, and for that they are saying the range, if fired, is about 1,400 kilometers.
Benam, is the concept behind hypersonic missiles a military could take out an adversary's armament so fast that there could be no or just limited counterattacks?
It's not just about the counterattack. It's about, first of all, the speed, reducing the time needed to actually get the adversary to detect, attract, and destroy. And second of all, further complicating that last leg, which is destroy, given the skipping and the gliding maneuvers that a hypersonic glide vehicle would be carrying out, creating a more unpredictable trajectory, which makes it even harder to shoot down. So if you have many of these weapons fired at once, it really could be a disaster scenario.
Yeah, I mean, the deal with Iran to limit its nuclear ambitions appears to be stalled out. How does the kind of announcement of this hypersonic missile in Iran play against this kind of stalled out JCPOA, the Iran nuclear deal?
I mean, in my view, the deal is dead, but the Biden administration's desire to use the corpse of the JCPOA is driven by its philosophical view, not policy view here. And its philosophy is that so long as you dangle the JCPOA in front of the Iranians, you dampen their ability or their desire inside Iran for more and more nuclear escalation. In my view, the past 2.5 years have proved the opposite of that, but this continues to be the operating assumption of the Biden administration. When you layer in some of these missiles, obviously, that is going to continue to close the door and reduce the value, in my view, of any such deal, particularly when you say this agreement, which still has the Europeans in it, is going to be even less valid come October because it's going to be having lapsing prohibitions on Iran's missile program at a time when its missile program, as you now see with the alleged hypersonic and even longer range liquid propellant systems, is growing in quality, quantity, and lethality.
We've been speaking with Benam Bentaloglu in Washington. He's a senior fellow at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. Good to have you with us, Benam. Thank you very much.
A pleasure. Thank you so much.
More news for you in the next half hour of the show. You're listening to The World. The most notorious double spy in FBI history has died. Robert Hansen passed secrets to the Soviets very carefully.
They would communicate, believe it or not, through putting thumbtacks around Washington in electrical poles.
Plus, drinking water runs low in Uruguay and people are outraged by the official fix, salty water. Ahead on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. It is one of the most dangerous migration routes in Asia, a weeks-long journey across the Bay of Bengal on wooden boats. On board are mostly Rohingya refugees. The Rohingya, you'll remember, were persecuted by the military in their home of Myanmar and were forced to flee. Destination, neighboring Bangladesh. And now in Bangladesh, more than 1 million Rohingya live in refugee camps. The conditions there are terrible, which is why many of them get on boats crossing the Bay of Bengal headed for Malaysia or Indonesia. Last year, more than 3,500 people attempted this route. Some 10% never made it. We teamed up for this next segment with the Associated Press to tell the story of one Rohingya mother named Setra Begum. She got in one of those boats and never made it to land. Kristen Gelino is an investigative reporter with the AP based in Sydney, Australia. Kristen, what led you to tell Setra's story?
I've been covering the Rohingya crisis since 2017, which is the year that Myanmar's military launched its ethnic cleansing campaign against the Rohingya. And over this past sailing season, I noticed there was a huge surge in the number of boats fleeing the refugee camps in Bangladesh. And one of my sources tipped me off about one particular boat carrying 180 people that left Bangladesh and then vanished. And it was just kind of shocking to me that 180 human beings could disappear, and the world didn't even blink. This was a forgotten boat of a forgotten people, and I was determined to find out what happened.
So that is the backstory. Stick with us, Kristen, and we'll have you back in a moment. With more on the story, here's the world's Southeast Asia correspondent, Patrick Nguyen.
It was a dark night under a full moon.
crammed onto a wooden boat on the Bay of Bengal were more than 180 people, and the boat was half swallowed by the sea. Setra Begum, a 38-year-old woman, was one of the passengers, and she feared she might die. Our boat has sunk. That's Setra calling her husband. He was in Malaysia, more than 1,000 miles away, and she was on her way to meet him, Setra and her two daughters. Oh God, our boat is sunk. It's only half afloat, she says. Tell my parents and pray for us. Now, Setra knew when she got on that boat 6 days before, on December 1st of last year, that it would be dangerous. But so was the place she was fleeing from, a refugee camp in Bangladesh set up for her people, the Rohingya. The Rohingya homeland is in Myanmar. That's where Setra was born. But over the years, they've been driven out in genocidal purges by Myanmar's army. Now, they're stuck in Bangladesh. The Rohingya camps are a maze of flimsy huts. It's crowded, it's dusty. People survive off meager handouts. Fires break out all the time. And local gangs prey on the refugees, kidnapping people for ransom. This is what Setra wanted to escape. Late last year, she got her chance. A cell phone video circulated in her section of the camp, and it showed a wooden boat, a little bigger than a school bus. That's the video of the boat, an ancient-looking vessel made of splintery planks. The person recording lifts a rusty steel door to show off the cargo hold. It looks like a dungeon down there, but this boat was it. A way out. On offer to Setra were spots for her and her two daughters for a total of $3,400, all the money she could scrounge up. The deal was the boat would take them and the other passengers, more than 180 people in all, across the sea, under a scorching sun, and illegally drop them in Indonesia. From there, Setra and her two girls would sneak over to Malaysia. Her husband had already made this journey 10 years before, and Setra was determined to join him. So off they went. That's a different woman named Kershida on the same boat as Setra and her daughters. She's calling a relative saying, "There is no God but Allah. Muhammad is the prophet," over and over, as if to comfort herself. The trip was off to a very bad start. Not long into the journey, the engine conked out in the middle of the ocean. That could have been it for the passengers. But in an extraordinary stroke of luck, another boat happened to pass by. Everyone looked over and saw this boat was also packed full of people. They too were Rohingya migrants making their own escape. That's a mobile phone video recorded by someone on the other boat. The winds are harsh, and there's nothing but blue water in every direction. The captain of Setra's boat called out, asking, "You got any electrical wire?" They did. He borrowed some and fixed his engine. Soon, they were on their way, the two boats sticking together, just in case they ran into more trouble. 4 days later, they did. A vicious late-night storm thrashed the boats, knocking supplies overboard. The Rohingya thought they could make out sharks circling in the sea. On Setra's boat, there was just a single light bulb, fending off the darkness. In a panic, she called her husband, Muhammad, in Malaysia, where it was 10:59 p.m. "Where are you?" he says. "Near Indonesia?"
"Indonesia?"
"I think India," she says, sounding unsure. She starts to say, "Please send help," but the signal cuts out mid-sentence. When it returns, Setra repeats, "Our boat, it's sunk. It's sunk by the storm." Hours later, the other boat was still above water, just barely, and its passengers stared across the dark sea at Setra's boat, watching its single light disappear under the waves. For The World, I'm Patrick Nguyen.
The audio in that story was collected by Associated Press reporter Kristen Gelinow. Such a harrowing story, Kristen. How did you obtain audio of these panicked phone calls and then actually piece this story together?
Well, I knew from my sources that passengers on the boat had made calls to their relatives, and I'd heard about this particular call made by Setra. So my primary goal upon arriving in the camps was to get my hands on this audio. So then it was just a matter of tracking down the source, which was Setra's husband, who lives in Malaysia. I then interviewed dozens of the passengers' family members, and the families were desperate for answers, so they were more than happy to hand over everything they had.
Wow. It occurs to me, if these migrants had phones, why couldn't they call authorities to help?
Even if the passengers had called rescue officials directly, it's unlikely that anyone would have helped them. There were multiple Rohingya boats that ran into trouble this sailing season, and many of those boats had satellite phones, so their exact GPS coordinates were available. And yet, even though their precise locations were known, the coastal countries in the region ignored repeated rescue requests by the United Nations and various NGOs. And as a result, many boats drifted for weeks, with people on board literally dying of thirst and drowning.
Kristen, your reporting indicates that more and more boats are attempting this route. Last year, these crossings tripled compared with the year before. What's leading people to take these risks on the high seas?
They're leaving because life in the camps has become almost unbearable, and it's getting worse every day.
I want us to hear the voice of Hasina Begum. She's a neighbor of Setra's and talking here about the conditions for the Rohingya community in Bangladesh.
We Rohingyas are now in dire need. I feel that a safe place would be great for us. We would be at peace if we could go to a safe place and be relieved from our misery. Due to our needs, we are forced to send our children abroad by boat.
So you visited these camps as part of your reporting. You mentioned that a moment ago, Kristen. Paint a picture of the conditions there.
Yeah, I mean, the spiraling security situation was evident from the moment I entered the camps. People looked scared, and the security issues started almost immediately. I had just finished up my very first interview on that first day when we got word that a massive fire had been set in Balukali camp, and children were screaming, women were sobbing, there were explosions ringing out. My colleague's clothes were literally burned when he was shooting the photos. He had to throw them out after. It was just total chaos. That fire, which was set by gangs, wiped out thousands of shelters, and it really set the tone for the whole week that followed. The next morning, we heard about a man who'd been shot to death in a tea shop, and then the next day, we got word that a man had been hacked to death in the middle of the afternoon. So it was just one thing after another.
Understandable why so many people want to leave those camps. Now, Myanmar, where the Rohingyas come from, and Bangladesh, those two countries are neighbors. They share a border. The people also have a lot of common culture, including shared majority religion, Islam. How have the Rohingya been received in Bangladesh generally?
Initially, there was overwhelming empathy and support for the Rohingya from the locals in Bangladesh. But as the years have dragged on, with no long-term solution to the crisis being offered, that goodwill has begun to dry up. And there's a sense that the Rohingya have overstayed their welcome.
So what is driving this anti-Rohingya sentiment in Bangladesh?
Bangladesh is a very poor country, and many of the locals have grown resentful of the resources being directed towards the Rohingya when they themselves are struggling. And the surge in violence in the camps has also hardened attitudes towards the Rohingya, even though the perpetrators of those crimes constitute a tiny minority of the Rohingya, and the main victims of those crimes are the Rohingya themselves.
For the Rohingya migrants who make it across the sea, Kristen, what sort of life awaits them on the other side, in Malaysia or Indonesia, for example?
Those who make it to Indonesia usually end up stuck for months in immigration shelters before traffickers link up with them again and take them the rest of the way to Malaysia. But it does come with risks. Many young Rohingya girls are forced into arranged marriages in Malaysia with much older men. And Malaysia is not a signatory to the Refugee Convention, which means that if they are caught, they can be arrested. So it's hardly paradise, yeah. But compared to the situation they're facing in the camps in Bangladesh, or the risk of death they would face in Myanmar from the military, Malaysia is often considered the best option.
It really seems the Rohingya are vulnerable pretty much everywhere they go. They're not welcome in Myanmar, obviously. Increasingly, that's the case in Bangladesh. Many are willing to risk death on the open ocean. Is there any outside action being taken to change their situation?
There's really a sense of global inertia when it comes to this crisis. Global donations have dried up as people's attention has shifted to other crises, like the war in Ukraine, and that's just made life even harder for the Rohingya living in these camps. Bangladesh has given no indication it plans to grant the Rohingya citizenship and allow them to leave the camps. And apart from issuing various sanctions on Myanmar's military, there's no coordinated global effort to try and oust those generals from power, which means the military that attacked the Rohingya will continue controlling Myanmar for the foreseeable future, and the Rohingya will have no safe way to return home.
Kristin Gelineau is an investigative reporter with the Associated Press. She joined us from Sydney, Australia. Kristin, thank you very much for your time and for your reporting.
Thank you so much.
For the past 3 years, Uruguay in South America has faced an historic drought. Freshwater reserves are at a dangerously low level. Authorities are now supplementing public drinking water from new, saltier reservoirs. That, in turn, has caused an uproar. Reporter Michael Fox has the story.
Last week, people hit the streets of Uruguay's capital, Montevideo, for the latest in a string of protests. They attacked the government's response to the ongoing drought and the increasingly salty taste of the water pouring from their taps. Many marched with their traditional mate gourds, from which they drink the South American green tea. You drink mate and it tastes salty, said teacher Paulo Padilla. The water's not potable, so you have to start to buy water, but that's not viable for everyone. There are families with 6 children or more. Until recently, Uruguay supplied residents with fresh water from several lakes, but it has now been cutting that with water from brackish reserves drawn from the Rio Plata. In early May, Uruguay roughly doubled its maximum limit for sodium levels in the country's water system to 440 milligrams per liter. That's roughly 20 times the recommended sodium levels in most U.S. states.
El agua, digamos, no es potable.
The water is not potable in the perfect definition of potability, said Environment Minister Robert Bouvier recently. But we say the water is consumable and drinkable, which is another definition.
Aquí tienen agua. Esto es un portalámpara.
Some Uruguayans have turned to science to criticize the state of affairs. In this video posted over social media, a man in an orange shirt lights a tiny bulb by passing an electric current through the salty tap water, something that could not happen with fresh water. This is dangerous, really dangerous for poor Uruguayans, he says. Uruguay's health ministry has recommended that pregnant women and those with certain pre-existing conditions not consume the water. Sodium consumption can be particularly dangerous for those with high blood pressure. Loren Dos Santos is with Uruguay's Pulmonary Hypertension Association, which is organizing to provide water to its members. Safe water is vital for all of our patients, she told a local news outlet. The idea is to buy it and for it to arrive quickly. And if the situation continues, we'll just have to keep it up. The government says this is the worst water crisis in the history of the country, but that they're doing their best to tackle the problem. We've never seen anything like this in the history of Uruguay, said the secretary to the president, Alvaro Delgado, in a recent address. And we're working for today and for tomorrow. Among the projects is a new water plant that could be operational in 2 years and providing water from the Rio Plata to 2 million more homes. But many Uruguayans say it's not enough. Videos like this have gone viral. It shows water from a broken main spilling across a street in Montevideo. Federico Kramerman, the president of the State Water Company Union, says they've been downsizing, and instead, they need to hire more workers. Everyone sees these broken pipes across the city, and they take a long time to repair, he says. Why? Because we don't have enough people to fix these problems. We have a crisis of personnel, he says. Environmental experts also blame the current water crisis on poor management of the country's water systems. Mariana Merhoff is an ecology professor at Uruguay's Universidad de la República. We have allowed the overexploitation of fresh water for productive activities, agriculture, irrigation, and big industry. This has been the priority, she says. And in this crisis, we believe that it took too long for the alarm to be sounded and to take measures. Merhoff says it's bad now, but climate change will make droughts like this even worse, and it's a sign that the country has serious work to do.
que creo que comienzan con reconocer que este problema...
There are a series of measures that can be taken, says Merhoff, including protecting watersheds and prohibiting certain agricultural activities. But, she says, it starts with recognizing that this problem is not going to go away the day it rains. Nevertheless, that is exactly what every Uruguayan is hoping for. Rain. For The World, I'm Michael Fox.
He was a double agent selling some of Washington's best-kept secrets to the Soviets and Russians. Robert Hansen became arguably the most damaging spy in FBI history. The FBI trusted him, but for 15 years he calmly went about his secretive work.
But in the mid-1980s, as Hansen, his wife, and six children were living in this house in the Washington suburbs, the epitome of a devout and devoted Catholic family, something seems to have gone terribly wrong.
That's from Dateline NBC. Robert Hansen died this week, age 79, in the Colorado Supermax prison, where he was serving a life sentence. He'd already been behind bars for more than two decades. To learn more about his story, we reached out to David Vise. He's the author of The Bureau and the Mole, The Unmasking of Robert Philip Hansen, the most dangerous double agent in FBI history.
Robert Hansen sold the continuity of government plan, the way the president, the Congress, and the Supreme Court would function, the super secret location they would go to in the event of nuclear war. He also sold the Russians information about a secret tunnel that had been put under the ground at enormous expense by the National Security Agency and the FBI. This was a tunnel in order to eavesdrop on everyone in the Russian embassy. He also gave up secret documents that the FBI had maintained about its operations outside the United States for years.
How did Hansen actually deliver these secrets to his handlers?
They would communicate through putting thumbtacks in, believe it or not, electrical poles. That would signal for Hansen and the Russians that something was going to happen. Hansen would go to a park near his house, leave the documents in the park, and the Russians would, in that same spot, leave him cash.
Wow. Details right out of John le Carré or The Americans. And his handlers, they played on his weaknesses, didn't they?
Yes, they did. He felt that he had never been promoted at the FBI to the level of his intelligence or his work. So the Russians played on his ego in a big way and made him feel super important. He was a guy who didn't believe in communism. He was a guy who was frustrated about not getting ahead. Ego is the number one reason that this happened.
I mean, that's an interesting point, because it does seem at one point in his career, Hansen was the archetypal Cold War warrior. I mean, he spoke of the Soviets as non-believer heathens. Did the FBI really not have any suspicion about who he really was?
The FBI and the CIA knew that there was a mole, that there was a spy from within. They were absolutely convinced the spy was inside the CIA. They even identified someone and ruined his life who was not the right person.
Who ultimately turned him in, and how was he caught?
The United States recruited a Russian spy who went into the archives in the Kremlin and stole information that Hansen had turned over. And whenever Hansen turned over information, he left it in a garbage bag. And they discovered fingerprints on that garbage bag, which matched Robert Hansen. And the Russians are very worried that when someone offers to be a spy, as he did, that they're being set up, you know, that they're being drawn into some U.S. plot. So the first thing that Hansen did was he gave the Russians the names of three officials from the Soviet Union who were in the United States and who were spying for Russia on the United States. And those three were summoned back to Russia under false pretense, and all three of them were executed. Hansen had blood on his hands.
Yeah, that's a grisly story. David, are you able to estimate how much money and assets Hansen was able to make over the years spying for the USSR and Russia?
$1.8 million. Meanwhile, while he was spying for Russia, he did an outstanding job in his role at the FBI.
This case was really damaging for the FBI, for its reputation, and for those it was working with abroad. How did it change how the FBI does business?
Hansen was never given a polygraph test during 20 years, not once, okay? Now the FBI gives polygraph tests and does a number of other things. The FBI does not blindly trust that just because people are working at the Bureau that they couldn't possibly be spies. He carried a lot of documents, by the way, right out of FBI headquarters, and he printed them out. So the FBI also has developed more security around people who leave with items that belong to the Bureau. I think they did take a lesson that just because someone was at the FBI, it didn't mean that they could be trusted necessarily.
David Vise is the author of The Bureau and the Mole, The Unmasking of Robert Philip Hansen, the Most Dangerous Double Agent in FBI History. David Vise, thank you very much for your time.
Marco, thank you very much.
Before we go, here's a little reminder for you listeners out there in your cars. Watch your speed, especially if you're listening to us on a podcast and driving in Finland.
The first thing we noticed when we came over the border into Finland was the number of speed cameras.
Foreign visitors learn Finland's rules of the road pretty quickly.
Okay, speed limit. Speed limit 100 km. Yeah, aap ye symbol bhi
dekh. A video there in Hindi called How to Drive in Finland. There are plenty of legit reasons to watch your speed when driving on Finnish roads. Moose, deer, even reindeer step into traffic. So Finland has strict enforcement of speed limits and a unique system for paying a ticket based on your daily income. The more you earn, the more you pay. This Helsinki cop explained it to Euronews.
The minimum is €6 per day fine. So it's always at least that, but it can go all the way to tens of thousands.
That's right, in the tens of thousands. And in fact, over the weekend, a Finnish multimillionaire was fined nearly $130,000 for driving 50 miles per hour in a 30 mile per hour zone. It's one of the largest fines in history, but in the Finnish system, the enormous fine is considered quite fair. The driver, Anders Wickloff, runs businesses ranging from real estate to helicopter services. He's one of the wealthiest people in the region, so he's paying up. This is not the first offense for Wickloff, by the way. He's got two previous substantial fines. We'll see if the third ticket is the charm. And with that, we speed off in a cloud of dust today. We come to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. I'm Marco Werman. Be safe, stay strong, and mind those traffic signs. We'll see you again tomorrow.
From PRX.